Good evening, everybody. You'll notice I'll just put in a little bit a commercial announcement. The early bird special for our third annual conference, our medical conference in the summer in Stowe, Vermont, is on Tuesday. It's even there are a few non-doctors in this room who I see who have attended in the past, and a few doctors who have. And it's really if you want a beautiful vacation in a great resort. You know, catered meals, great speakers, a great ambiance. It's something to put on your agenda. For those who are more adventurous, a week and a half later, we're having a trip to Europe. On my way here on the phone, I got a phone call from a friend of mine to confirm he and four of his other friends are coming. Six people, three couples whom I'm friendly with as I was on my way here, which is nice. The trip is filling up. And the Europe trip, it's a limited trip onto one bus. So that, if you're interested, Mark Shapiro is really is superb. Those who know him, I really think there's nobody more qualified to lead a trip on Jewish history to Central Europe. We'll be seeing all the Jewish sites and the non-Jewish sites, Prague, a beautiful city, I understand, Vienna, Budapest, many other places. So that I encourage you to attend if you'd like to. And here come our guest speakers. I'm going to let Elliot do the official introduction, but I just want to say it's an honor to have Rabbi Weiss here, who's really one of the great activists and the great leaders in the Orthodox world for many, many years. I was in his shul on a Kat Shabbaton in Simchas Torah in 1985.
Wow.
And I have not been back since to Riverdale for a Shabbos. And I remember at the time the walls were not finished. I don't know if they are now. And the explanation I was given is Zecher L'Churban. They wanted to have. And if anybody's ever been to Rabbi Weiss's shul, it's an unbelievable place. The warmth, the openness. What goes on, I understand, the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the whole community, really, he's, what he's often is, I assume, outside of his shul, he's less well-known for the amazing rabbi he's been to the community, over 800 families, I understand. So it's really an honor to have you here. And in that vein, I want to thank the Shipp family who are sponsoring the evening and, I guess a little bit in memory of their father and in support of our activities. I want to thank Randy and the whole family, and we should have good occasions to work together for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. And yeshu koach to you and your family for all the many, many wonderful things you do on behalf of the Jewish people. Without further ado, Elliot, bakasha.
Good evening again. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut. Those of you who've been following the last number of years will trace that we've been doing a number of these interviews. We started out in 2007 with Rabbi Abraham Twersky. We also did interviews with Rabbi Natan Lopez Cardozo, Professor Lawrence Schiffman, Dr. Tamar Ross, and in London with Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. It's my pleasure this evening to introduce to you Rabbi Avram Weiss, who is the founder and president of Yeshivat Chovei Torah, the modern Open Orthodox Rabbinical School in New York. He's also the senior rabbi of the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, a congregation of 850 families, and most recently founded Yeshivat Maharat, a modern Open Orthodox school training women to become spiritual leaders. Rabbi Weiss was named one of the 50 most influential rabbis in America by Newsweek magazine for three consecutive years. He is the author of Spiritual Activism, A Jewish Guide to Leadership and Repairing the World, and has served as the national chairman of the Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry and the national president of AMCHA, the Coalition for Jewish Concerns. Won't you please welcome Rabbi Avi Weiss. One of the goals of these...
Just before you begin, yep. Elliot, since I'm the guest, so... first of all, it's wonderful to be at Shar Shemayim, and with your permission, I wanted to dedicate this evening's give and take to something that's been on my mind for the past few days, and I wanted to dedicate the evening to the Fogel family, to Rabbi Udi and Ruthie Fogel, who were so mercilessly murdered in Itamar. I want to remember their names. I want to remember their children, little Hadas and Yoav and Elad. And also in the same breath, to remember what's happening in Japan. There are so many people who have lost their lives. And with your permission, my general minhag is before I share some Torah, we sing. So I'd like to offer a tefillah through Nigun and ask you to join me. Parcheinu avinu kulanu ke'echad kulanu ke'echad be'or panecha Parcheinu avinu kulanu ke'echad kulanu ke'echad be'or panecha Bachenu avinu kuvulanu ke'echad kuvulanu ke'echad be'or panecha Bachenu avinu kuvulanu ke'echad kuvulanu ke'echad be'or panecha.
I'm actually perfectly satisfied to sing for the rest of the evening.
And so am I. Does anybody have a pen, perhaps?
Yeah.
A pen? Oh, great. Okay, good.
The goal of these interviews is to trace a journey of a life, not simply to focus on any one part of a life. And so what we do here is we go right back to the beginning. Now, Rabbi Weiss, I wanted you to tell us briefly where and when you grew up and describe your upbringing in terms of religion. How would you depict your parents' relationship to Judaism? Were there differences between your mother and father and the kinds of emphases that they placed?
I was born at the tail end of the Shoah. My father was actually raised in the town of Oświęcim, which then became Auschwitz. And he was raised as a Bava V'chassid. And he came to the United States. Indeed, many of his siblings, three of his siblings, perished during the Shoah, but he came in the mid-30s. And although he remained connected to Baviv, he became one of the leaders in the Shoma Hadati movement, which was the precursor of the B'nai Akiva. He actually was Rosh Moshava in Chicago for many years and Rosh Hakshara in Livingston Manor in New Jersey. My mother was American-born, lost many of her aunts and uncles during the Shoah, and she was a very broad thinker, and she read from the broad spectrum of literature. And she was so sweet and so kind. And to this day, whenever I'm interacting with people, I feel her presence. I can feel her tapping me on my shoulder sometimes. So in that sense, I was raised in a home that was fervently religious Zionist, and I was raised in a home that had a great love for Hasidus. And ultimately, my parents actually bought a camp, and I was raised in Camp Asia, which was sort of like a private moshava or a private masad, Ivri Dati. And during those years, I was very, very much exposed to the power of informal education. A lot of my rabbinate has to do with that informal leadership. My parents also instilled within us a tremendous, tremendous sense of family. I'm blessed with four siblings, and we've each taken very, very different paths. My sister, Tova Reich, is, I say this very objectively, one of the great novelists in the world today. Her most recent book is a very controversial book called My Holocaust. And I think her relationship to orthodoxy as a woman influenced me tremendously. I have a brother who's less than a year younger, Mordechai, who is a great educator, who led his school in Atlantic City for almost 30 years and now is the principal of the day school in West Hartford. I have a beautiful sister who I consider my mentor in spirituality, who was a flower child of the 60s, and she's still living probably in a certain sense in the 60s. And my brother, who is here somewhere, is one of the brilliant industrial psychologists living here in New York, has written extraordinary works on leadership. As a matter of fact, his book, Innovative Intelligence, I'm told, is going to be listed by Globe and Mail as the number one best business book in the country. And he's one of the leaders of a very important congregation here called the Nariva Congregation, where he leads services on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So we've taken different paths, but there's something that we've maintained, and that is just an endless, unconditional love for each other.
When you were a child, do you remember your earliest feelings about Judaism, about God, about faith? Did you have a feeling of faith then? If you didn't, from where did it emerge? And did the issues that came to mark your career, specifically the activism, the sense of concern for brothers and sisters, did that already exercise you as a teenager, or did that come later on?
There wasn't that much God talk in our home, but you could feel the presence of God in my parents' home. My father and mother sent me, believe it or not, to a Haredi yeshiva. I graduated Yeshiva Torah Vadas. And I don't remember much of what I learned there, but I do remember individual personalities to this day. I remember Reb Chaim Gelb, the way he would say Amen and Yehei Shmei Rabba. I was very inspired by a Rebbe called Rabbi Moshe Wolfson. I can still see him singing Umalki Tzedek Melech Shalem, Umalki Tzedek Melech Shalem. Verot givein Malki Tzedek, Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem. He had a big, I actually once, one week, if you were a good student, you were permitted to sing whatever song you wanted to sing, and I got the prize. So I stood up, stood at attention, I started singing Hatikva. And he pretty quickly stopped me. And I always wanted to thank him. And many years later, I went to see him. He was then the Mashkiach in Torah Vadas. And I walked him. I said, Rebbe, do you remember me? He said, no. I stood up at attention, started at Tikva. He said, now I remember you. And then I went on to high school, where I majored in a very important subject called basketball. And I was raised on stories and packages. I was raised on my father's stories. He went to Poland. And he was the first to instill within me a sense of Jewish activism. He visited Poland in 1959 looking for his brothers and sisters. And I remember the stories when he came back, told us the story, Elliot, told us the story of how he stood in Auschwitz, and it was during the winter, and his guide said, "Too bad you're not here during the summer, because the grass in Auschwitz is especially beautiful, because the grass in Auschwitz is blue, because we use the fertilizers of human remains to grow the grass." Those were the stories I heard, and the packages. My father organized a campaign to send packages to Poland, and I can still remember our home and my father's shul. I can see my mother preparing those packages. And then I went off to Israel, to Yeshivat Keren B'Yavne in 1961-62, and learned with young men who were in the army, and I was deeply touched. So I felt and I understood the need to stand up for Jewish causes, although coming as I did from a yeshivisha background, it did take me a while to translate that theory into reality.
How did the segue work? How did you morph out of one sort of identity to another, or did you fuse the two?
I think it took me time to move into the world of activism. I was, for example, very much involved in the Soviet Jewry movement, but I did not go to rallies. when Glenn Richt and Yaakov Birnbaum started the rally effort in 1963 and 1964. I keep thinking about that because I feel somewhat shamed that I was not out there protesting with them. It took me a couple of years, and then I worked it out, and I was able to translate the responsibility of Shomer Achi Anochi on some level into a reality.
When did you enter YU? When did that happen?
I entered YU in 1962, and I graduated in 1966.
And what was the experience there like? Did you have much interaction with Rabbi Soloveitchik? Or?
I was very influenced by Reb Aaron, by his younger brother. I remember the first day when I was in Reb Aaron's shir, I was sitting in the back, and then he walked in. He didn't say a word. He walked in, and I will never, ever forget the way he walked in. He walked in with such humility, such a sense of self-effacement, and from the next day on, I was sitting right in front of Reb Aaron. I was in the Rav Shir as a very young man. I was 19 years old, and looking back, I really wasn't ready for the Rav Shir. I was very frightened of him, and he could be a very intimidating figure, and after 2 years, I decided I wanted to leave his Shir. I'm one of the few students to have left the Rav Shir, and I went to Rav David Lifshitz, and he was a Rebbe. He really had a tremendous, tremendous influence on my life. After I came back from St. Louis, where I was a rabbi for a year in Kreef Corps, and St. Louis had a big impact on my life because this was the first time a yeshiva boy was in the open world and seeing the real world, then I became much closer to the Rav. I started attending his Tuesday night classes in Moriah, and I was very taken by him. And in time, I would visit him once a month, and I would talk with him one-on-one, and that's what I really treasure. I remember sitting with the Rav and talking about the machitza in our shul, which is a very unusual machitza, and he signed off on the machitza. I remember taking Avital Sharansky to see the Rav, and the Rav said to me, all I can tell you is take her to tip, take her to tip. And then I realized what he meant was take her to Tip O'Neill, who was from Boston, and then, of course, he was the Speaker of the House. That was the Rav. The Rav in those areas, he would say, instead of coming to me for answers, go to the Sovietologist, go to Tip O'Neill. And one moment I'll never forget, I was dealing with a very complicated question of Mamzerut. And by that time, the Rav, it was somewhat difficult for him to completely focus. This was towards the end of his tenure. And what I'll never forget, and as I say it, I have the chills from head to toe, he would find it difficult to concentrate. And this discussion was going on from one visit to another, and he would say to me, Abraham, what about that young girl? What about the issue? Were you able to solve it? Did you go to Rabbi Feinstein, he said, during those days. So I feel very, very indebted to the Rav. I feel very indebted to Rav David Lifshitz and to Rav Aaron, who I called Mori V'Rabbi for many, many years.
Let's talk a little bit about the founding of HIR, your synagogue. You were in your late 20s, I guess, and it was very small. It was a few dozen families. I think it was in the boiler room of the Whitehall building, right, off the Henry Hudson Parkway. And now, as Rabbi Kelvin mentioned, the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale is over 850 families. I'm interested in what you saw at the time as the principles that you were holding that you wanted to imbue in the shul. In other words, what was the vision that informed the shul for you then and now, and what kind of community especially were you looking to build?
I'm a big chassid of the quote that's attributed to Robert Kennedy, who once said, some people see things as they are and ask why, others see things as they should be and ask why not. And when I came to Riverdale and we were in the boiler room of the Whitehall building, there wasn't much there. And it was a dream. It was a vision. And there were wonderful people who joined me in that vision. And I would say the core principle of the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale is, I prefer not calling it the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. Names are descriptions of who we are. And we call the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale the Bayit. As a bayit is a home, a place of love and welcome, That is our most basic message, to allow all Jews, regardless of affiliation, regardless of commitment, regardless of background, to feel very, very welcome. So we would do all kinds of things to make people feel welcome. Ongoing programs for special friends. Those are people who are sometimes called retarded. That's a term I never use. Special friends. Ongoing programs for people who are shut-ins. I've always felt that the test of community is not the way you reach out to the most powerful, but the way you reach out to the most vulnerable. And we started free Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur services in the afternoon. Over the years, thousands of people have come. Free Pesach Sedarim. To this day, every Friday night, we have what is called Abraham and Sarah's Tent. It's extraordinary, I must say, and I can say this because the Bayit is not me. The Bayit is many, many people. It's Rabbi Stephen, Rabbi Sarah, so many people. It is such an intergenerational, heterogeneous group. And yet, separate from that, it's a shul. So when you come into Davin, we really try to talk to God. And we are blessed with the person who, for me, is the greatest Baal Tefillah in the world, Dr. Eli Kranzler, the voice of Dvikut. I welcome you. I invite you all to come. The Torah that we teach is a Torah that exposes people to values. We never try to impose values. And the shul, the bayit, became a bedrock, a foundation for Jewish activism. You can get a sense of who we are when you just walk into the structure. When you walk into the building, if men and women would not be inside the shul, you would not know on which side men or women sit. It is right down the middle, and then the mechitza merges into a lifted bima, and the mechitza goes around the bima and around a lifted Aron Kodesh. So the bima is really a third section. It's a neutral section. So Rabbi Sarah Horowitz, for example, to this day often gives the drasha during tefillah because she is in a neutral section. She is, in effect, separated from the men and separated from the women. For me, a beautiful synagogue is a synagogue that's accessible. So not only are there ramps into the shul, but in the sanctuary itself, literally going up to the bima. It's also structured in such a way that the rabbi doesn't sit in the front. I sit amongst the people. Right. Every aliyah, I try to go from place to place in the men's section. It's very simple, very open. And that's our attempt to create this open, welcoming community. You get very interesting because I try to be the first to the door to welcome people. And when people come in, they may know my name, but they don't know what I look like. So they often don't know who they're talking to. And I would sit near them and I would find out what they think about me before I would introduce myself. And it could get a little scary sometimes. You never know who's coming to the bayit. You can be sitting next to someone who learns Shas Daf Yomi, and I encourage you to go to the website to listen to Rabbi Dov Linzer, who gives our Daf Yomi shiur. It's one of the best dafs in the world. And on the other side, you could be sitting to someone with minimal background, and both are holy.
The first time I actually heard about you was in regard to the struggle for Soviet Jewry. And the way I heard about you is actually from my wife, who's from Elizabeth, New Jersey, Rabbi Teitz's community. And when I met my wife, we were talking about what is the best way to approach tyrannical power. And Rabbi Teitz's method was to be very quiet about it, he felt that for whatever reasons that you didn't want to upset the powers that be and you wanted to sort of try and influence them in a very quiet way. And I was very struck by the fact that there was another approach, and that approach was to be much more vocal and much more outward. And for years, you led protests at the Russian diplomatic residence in Riverdale, which I guess was coordinated by the student struggle for Soviet Jewry. I want you to describe how you became involved in the fight on behalf of Soviet Jews and perhaps talk about these different approaches and why you chose your approach.
Well, there, of course, were thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who were involved in the Soviet Jewry movement. In fact, I remember coming to Toronto with Avital Sharansky to B'nai Torah. I remember how warmly we were greeted by the late Rabbi Raphael Marcus. I remember going to Beth Tikva, where Rabbi Wayne Allen serves, with Avital, because Natan is actually related to the Solomons, who are members of the Beth Tikva synagogue. So Toronto and Erwin Cutler and others really played a very, very central role, as did many, many people. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary movement. I remember just a story about Avital. I'll never forget coming to a Toronto airport. And I think it was on the trip to B'nai Torah, and there was a woman off to the side. And she came up to me and she said, "Is that Avital Sharansky?" Because Avital, Natan's wife, was campaigning on his behalf. And I said, "Yes, that is Avital." And she walked up to Avital, and she was carrying her infant daughter, and she said, "Avital, I want you to meet my daughter. Her name is Avital, and I named her in your honor." So this was really a worldwide movement, and there were so many people involved. Again, I mentioned Glenn Richter, my Rebbe in spiritual activism, and Yaakov Birnbaum. I was inspired by Never Again in the Shoah. There was a time in my life that I was very inspired by Rabbi Meir Kahana. We broke on a whole variety of issues. The night after he was assassinated, we were supposed to debate in Riverdale. As a matter of fact, they found in his pocket a note that said that he thought that my life was in jeopardy. And from that point on, for many, many years, I was under police protection. Our daughter Ilana, when she was married, there were cops all over. My wife Toby tells the story that she wanted to stay calm because those were very complicated days for us. And so what she tells the story that she was lying down, and I guess the person putting on makeup put tea bags on the eyes. It's supposed to do something for you. I'm not a maven in this. And she's trying to relax, you know, with our other daughter, Dina. She's relaxing. Everything's going fine. Suddenly, there's a knock on the door. So they say, "Who is it?" The response is, "Bomb squad, you know." How are you going to, because the police were actually there. So I was inspired by Never Again. I was certainly inspired by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., inspired by Milchemet HaSheshet HaYamim, and became very much involved in activism. I remember once debating Rabbi Teitz. We once debated in the Jewish Center. I look back with great regret to the way I conducted myself that night. It just so happens that last week I happened to have heard that tape. And what I'm most sorry about, and I wish I had the chance to apologize to him, is I felt I didn't treat him respectfully. He was at least twice my age, and he deserved much more respect, and he deserves much more credit than I gave him. I've told him this. I told this to his daughter, to Rivka, and look, he was a very, very strong proponent of quiet diplomacy, and he felt that public pressure didn't help. And I was of the opinion, and others were of the opinion, and before we did this, we went to the Rav, and Rabbi Soloveitchik said, "I won't respond, but go to a Sovietologist." And the Sovietologist told us that public pressure is important. Public protest was important in bringing pressure against the Soviet Union. They were very, very sensitive to this pressure because they were presenting the Soviet Empire as an idyllic society. It was also very, very important in terms of helping quiet diplomacy. The single most important legislation that I think sprung Soviet Jewry was the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which linked the freedom of Soviet Jews, human rights, to trade and most favored nation status. What Jackson-Vanik basically said is that trade, the bridge of trade, would be based on the pillars of human rights. Now, Jackson and Vanik, we believe, pushed for that amendment because of public protest. It was American protest pressure which told people in the legislature, people in Congress, that this issue is important. And in that sense, public pressure and quiet diplomacy work together. And on top of that, public protest, as Soviet Jews themselves have said, was very important and telling Soviet Jews that they were not alone. So I would put it this way, whereas Rabbi Teitz of blessed memory believed in quiet diplomacy and thought that public pressure was counterproductive, we believed in quiet diplomacy. We felt that it was essential, but we felt that the engine of quiet diplomacy was public protest, and they worked in orchestration.
How far does one take that? I'm interested because you've been arrested many times, 11 that I could count. I'm missing some.
You're missing some.
So obviously you are, you know, philosophically ready to be arrested and are aware of the fact of, and do you see that as inherent in being a social activist? In other words, taking the risk, recognizing the consequences, not shirking from that.
I think it's a form of protest. There are all kinds of protest, and we're all in a symphony. And I believe that there is a symphony of Rabbi Teitz type of advocacy, which is noble, what Chabad did in the former Soviet Union, which is nothing less than absolutely extraordinary, and the Rebbe was very, very much opposed to public protest. Maybe publicly he was opposed to it so that it could make him more effective when his shluchim went into the former Soviet Union and did what they did. I'm not really sure. That's a form of protest. Gathering in the streets is a very important form of protest. And I believe that nonviolent civil disobedience, going into the lion's den, going to the point of tension, is equally important. I believe that to be the role of a rabbi. There are many rabbis who are involved in political and social justice and political activism on behalf of Am Yisrael. There are some rabbis who shirk that responsibility because they divide religion and state. What I've learned in my rabbinate is the best sermon, I don't like that term, the best Dvar Torah a rabbi can give is not so much what you say, it's what you do. When Abraham Heschel marched in Selma, it is said that someone said to him, "Dr. Heschel, you're a person of prayer. What are you doing marching in Selma?" And he said, "I was praying with my feet. I was praying with my feet." I think that there are rabbis who don't like getting involved in these kinds of protests because inevitably when you're speaking out, no matter what you're speaking out for, you're going to alienate half your board, half your congregation. I'm reminded of the statement of, I think it was Rabbi Saul Salanter who once said, he said, "A rabbi who is loved by everyone is not a rabbi. And a rabbi who's hated by everyone is not a mensch." Part of being a rabbi is you do take stands. You do take stands. And, of course, the stuff that I did on some level, and there were many who did it with me, was dangerous. I was stricken with two heart attacks during demonstrations. On September 2nd, 1986, we were protesting against the Mosiev Dance Company. And we were outside peacefully protesting, and someone released a Molotov cocktail on the inside, and people came out in swarms, and I was stricken with a heart attack. And 10 years later, on the hills of Efrat, a second heart attack started. My wife always says, "Didn't you get the message? It's about time to stop." And I think now that kind of protest and advocacy, it's for a younger generation.
Let's talk about the younger generation, because as an educator, and many colleagues of mine in the room who are educators, are interested in how we reignite, especially among young people, the desire for public spiritedness. There's a lot of literature, which I'm sure everybody's familiar with, supposedly rehearsing the idea that contemporary people are, you know, narcissistic and individualistic and, you know, introverted and so on. But I wonder whether there isn't a place that can be played, right, for that kind of public spiritedness. The question is, how do we move children away from a kind of pervasive individualism into a feeling of social responsibility?
There is narcissism, and I think Western culture is very, very much me, and it's the pronoun I. But I am a strong believer in Viktor Frankl's idea that people seek meaning in life. And for me, the best way to achieve meaning is through the process of serving, through the process of giving of oneself to another. And as a theologian, as a rabbi, that is a fundamental Jewish concept. Ben Azai in the Yerushalmi in the Darim says that the most important concept is Zeh Sefer Toldot HaAdam, that every human being is created in the image of God. That means when I look at you and you look at me, on the surface we see what we see. But if we look deeply into each other, we should be able to see a little bit of God. And as God gives, Mahu Rachum, Afata Rachum. Mahu Chanun, Afata Chanun. As God, by definition, gives, so too inherent within us is the capacity to give. Now, you touched on something when you spoke about perhaps there should be some formula of pushing for national service. Now, on the one hand, I am unalterably opposed to Kfiyat HaDat. Spiritual striving does not come from coercion. If you're coercive, as we see in Israel, it turns people off. But in thinking about it, I think that's especially true relative to Ben Adam LaMakom. It's true in ritual. When it comes to V'shamru Derech Hashem, Lasot Tzedakah U'Mishpat, the mission of Yahdut, of doing righteousness and justice, then I think there may be a place for there to be mandated some time for young people to give. We mandate compulsory education. And so instead of students mandated to study in school for 12 years, however long it is, why not add a year? Or why not make the last year one of national service? My sense is that either you want to do it, and even if you don't, Yahadut, as the Sefer Chinuch points out, is behavioral psychology. We are Naseh V'Nishma. You may not feel like doing it, but if you're from the doing could come the feeling. And so I do think that some kind of public service, that culture is important. One of our children, Ilana now lives with her husband, Michael, in Israel, and they live in Efrat, so they're going through a lot with what happened in Itamar, and they're out of Tinek 5 years ago. And their children are very much in the Israeli culture. Their eldest, they're blessed with 9 children. Their eldest, Gilad, is now going into the army. So I recently said to Gilad, because I'm very concerned about the army and how he'll do. He's American. I said to him, Gilad, you're going to the army? He said, of course. I said, what do you want to do in the army? Gilad said, I'm Avi, and Saba is grandfather, so they call me Savi Avi, or in Israel, everything is Sababa, I'm Sababi. He said, Sababi, I want to be a fighter. So I said, Gilad, why do you want to be a fighter? And I was afraid. I didn't want him to tell me he wants to kill Arabs. My heart stopped. And he looked at me, and he said the following. He said, Sababi, Israel has given me so much. I want to give back. I could kiss him 100 times. That's the culture in Israel. By and large, that's the culture. I know that there are issues, but you give. You give when you finish high school. And I think there's got to be a reorientation in America. I'd like to see in Yeshiva High School there at least be discussions in the 12th year of what are our responsibilities to serving in Israel? Is the responsibility to defend Israel only an Israeli responsibility? Or is it a broader Jewish responsibility? Try that, and there'll be a big pushback from parents. And it shouldn't be that way.
Let's turn in a different direction and start to talk a little bit about more recent years. You were a teacher for many years at Yeshiva University, and I know that your children also attended school there. Can you describe the period of time, the issues in the atmosphere that led you to leave YU?
Well, first I want to express great gratitude to Yeshiva University. I was especially close to Dr. Belkin, past president. I consider Dr. Lamb to be one of my rabbeim. I've read all of his works. I think he is one of the brilliant thinkers of the 20th century. May God bless him with many, many more years. My father was ordained at Yeshiva University. My father received his doctorate at Yeshiva University from the Bernard Revel Graduate School. He wrote on Sefer Rushano, it's a Rishon, who wrote on Chamisha Chumshei Torah, every single one of my siblings went to Yeshiva University. Every single one of our children went to Yeshiva University, including our son Dov, who was instrumental in the creation of Chovevei Torah. So allow a father a little bit of pride. We love all of our children. Dina, who's a paper cut artist, you can look her up. And Ilana's in Israel. And Dov is finishing his doctorate at the University of Chicago, studying with Dr. Michael Fishbane in the Divinity School. And he's going on. He'll be teaching at the University of Illinois and got a postdoc at Harvard. Very nice. And I think the nicest hour of my week is an hour a week we learn Medrash. He wrote on the Medrash Tanchuma. And I should say, I try to hold on to him because he's really my Rebbe. He is so beyond me in learning. And I understand the statement, Bakol adam mitkanei chutz mibanav ubnotav. We're jealous about everything except our children. God bless him. So I'm very, very indebted to Yeshiva University. My wife served as the director of Yeshiva University alumni. I taught at Yeshiva University for 30 years. I'm looking here to see if any women are looking at my feet. The reason I'm asking that is I never taught with shoes. So when I travel the country, invariably I'm going to meet someone who was a student of mine. I am wearing my shoes now. I don't know why, because I don't like teaching in shoes. I had 30 glorious years. I was blessed with between 4,000 and 5,000 students. I was ordained at Yeshiva. I feel very indebted. And I left Yeshiva University on the best of terms. I just was the founder, along with others, of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah and the rabbi of this large synagogue. And it was just impossible for me to carry the load. I felt that it was important at that time to begin a new rabbinical school. And look, foundationally, I think competition is good. There's more than one Yeshivat Hester. I think there should be more than one modern Orthodox rabbinical school. I think it's good. We're a smaller school, and we're not a theological seminary. We are a rabbinical school. There's a very big difference between the two. If you're a theological seminary, then half your students could be learning for the sake of learning, and they may have no interest in going to Avodat HaKodesh. You can't be a student at Chovevei without making a commitment to serve. And it's a school that really tries to prepare students not only in learning but in other facets of the rabbinate. Truth be told, I did feel, and I say this with great respect, I did feel that there was a precipitous move to the right. And as one who loves Yahadut and loves modern, what I call open orthodoxy, I felt it was absolutely necessary for there to be that voice. I felt it was necessary for there to be that kind of school. And without getting into the particulars, I would say that what really pushed me over the top were certain experiences that my son had with his Rebbe, and I came to the realization with Dov and with his friends that this was an absolute necessity. I just felt it was necessary.
You wrote about open orthodoxy. I remember, in fact, the first time I was exposed to it, I believe, if I remember correctly, you wrote an article that appeared in Judaism magazine in the 90s, which is where I first came across it. What would you describe as open orthodoxy? And I think almost as importantly, what do you see as its limits?
Wow, you have a couple hours? No. First, open orthodox is, Rabbi Soloveitchik, I once heard him say, Eden is not paradise. Eden is paradox. So when you think orthodox, very often you think closed. When you think open, you don't think orthodox. And yet, I think profound creativity and religious striving and growth comes from that dialectic. So open orthodox is orthodox. Orthodox means that there is a profound belief in heteronomous law of Torah min HaShemayim, of belief that God gave the Torah. It is a commitment to passionate avodat Hashem, passionate service of God. It is a commitment to the minutiae of halakha. And I think what sets apart orthodoxy is that our approach to halakha is cumulative in nature, which would require a much longer period of time to discuss and decipher. And yet, even as it is orthodox, it is open. What does it mean that it's open? It's open to different voices. It's inclusive. That means whatever one's level of learning, whatever one's level of knowledge, someone has something to bring to the table. It means open in the sense that relative to Ben Adam Lamakom, relative to our relationship with God, we're absolutely non-judgmental. I am non-judgmental in those areas to the non-judgmental power. I remember saying this at a conference. I remember saying this at some convention. And one of my mentors, 20 years older than me, said, Avi, you are so non-judgmental that for you there is no such thing as a tzaddik or a rasha. And I respectfully responded and said, and this is my philosophy, I'm sure there is such a thing as a tzaddik and a rasha, but I'll let God decide who's a tzaddik and a rasha. Relative to our relationship with God, that's not a decision that I'm going to make.
From your point of view, how do you perceive limits? In other words, I could understand openness and closedness in terms of acceptance of different kinds of human beings, different learning levels. The crux of the matter often comes down to halakha. So I'm wondering, from your point of view, do you see certain sort of red lines that can't be crossed in the halakha? And how would you define those? And how would you define the ones that you feel are more flexible or more open to new ways of thinking?
Right. It's a complicated, a broad question, but I'll speak in general terms and invite me back, and I'm happy to get into the specifics. I touched upon it when I spoke about what orthodox is. There are limits. There are limits, and I submit. I submit to Torah law. I submit to the halakha. I'll give you an example. The Torah says that a Kohen can't marry a Grusha. That's a complicated law. And in terms of the real world, it could be very difficult. There have been so many occasions in my lifetime, in my rabbinate, where a couple comes to me and they're in that situation. Now, it's no secret that Rav Moshe talks about looking into the lineage of someone to really ascertain if the person is a Kohen. Is this woman really a grusha based on certain halachic considerations? And so it's not uncommon for rabbis to try to do what they can to find a way. But as it occurred just 2 weeks ago, I couldn't find a way. And those are the limits. Halacha, and what I meant by that is, I submit. Halacha is not monolithic. There is latitude and flexibility in the halacha, but within parameters. Within certain parameters, within certain boundaries, within certain limits. I mean, in a certain sense, open orthodoxy is it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid of, on the one hand, she'al avicha v'yagedcha, going to history, going to parents, going to the past, and that's a hybrid with. The Torah says, "Ki palei mimcha dava," when something is too wondrous, "Vekamta valita el ha-shofet ha-sheyeh bayamim ha-him." You go to the judge of your generation. And what I am finding is, I'm finding across North America, I know I'm in Canada, so I'm careful, across North America, I'm finding that Jews are looking for a Judaism that is rooted. People want a Judaism that is rooted, that has history, that has tradition, as long as it's not stagnant. And the flip side of the coin is people want something that's open and fluid as long as it's got parameters. And I think that that's the message of open orthodox. The details are required in specific cases as to how in specific areas that would be worked out.
Well, so let's use a paradigm example here of where one person's limits is another person's crossing the limits. Because to me, when we talk about limits and what can't be crossed, you're almost entering into a level of subjectivity at certain points. So your commitment to supporting rethinking the place of women within Orthodoxy is very well known. I want you to describe for us the thought process that you underwent in opening a new yeshiva to train women as halachic and spiritual leaders, and then to subsequently confer the titles of Marat and Rabbah on Sarah Hurwitz. I'm specifically interested whether you expected to be roundly castigated for those decisions. Did that come as a surprise? Was that something that you had expected would happen? Or has the level of rhetoric surprised you?
The level of rhetoric did surprise me. And I share with you was very, very painful. It was painful because I was especially vulnerable to what my wife Toby was feeling. And when Ilana calls from Israel and says, Abba, what's happening? It's all over the papers. What are you? Who are you? It was extremely, extremely painful. During my lifetime, with others, we've confronted many of the external enemies of Am Yisrael, whether it's the Soviet government, the Polish government, the Argentinian government, it goes on and on. That was not painful. But when it comes from the inside, from the inner family, for me it was personally very, very painful. I did not believe that I was doing anything radical. I felt that there had been over the last 100 years an evolvement of the role of women in halakha. Probably the most radical step was taken in the earlier part of the 20th century when the Chafetz Chaim said that women should be studying Torah. And 50 years later, the Drisha Institute, Rabbi David Silber, introduced Torah Sheba'al Peh and the highest learning for women. And Stern College for Women now has a very advanced kollel program where women are studying Talmud on the same level as men. And in the aftermath of that, there are women now who are serving as Yoatzot Halacha in the area of family purity. There are Toanot. There are women who are in Batei Dinim. And there are many women who are serving in spiritual leadership in synagogues. Lincoln Square Synagogue is blessed with a wonderful woman, with Ilana, who is a spiritual leader 24/7 there. Ashilo Patton Shul, Anshe Shalom, has a full-time woman who works in spiritual leadership in his synagogue, as we do with Rabbah Sarah Hurwitz. There are synagogues that have women who are congregational spiritual interns at Kehilat Jeshurun. That's an example. And there are other examples. Lynn Kay, who's at the Spanish-Portuguese Shul, also works full-time there. What I did that was different is I gave it a title. I called it Rabbah. And that's where I think I took a step and went where others have not gone. But functionally, there was literally no difference in terms of the spiritual leadership in synagogues. Now, when I used the term Rabbah, I did that purposefully. For me, Rabbah is not rabbi. I would not call a woman spiritual leader a rabbi. And I'll tell you why. Orthodoxy is not egalitarian. We're not egalitarian. So while it is true that 90% of what a woman spiritual leader can do, 90% of what a rabbi can do, women can do, 10%, a very significant 10%, women can't do. They can't do. So there are things that a rabbi can do that a woman can't do. Just as, by the way, there are things that women can do in spiritual leadership that a man can't do. For example, Rabbah Sarah can't be on a bet din for conversion. But she does something which is even more instrumental. What she can do is that she can counsel the woman Gioret and literally take the woman into the mikveh. That's a very, very powerful moment. And there are other such examples. And from my perspective, the sky's the limit in terms of women functioning as spiritual leaders in universities, in schools, as chaplains in hospitals, and in synagogues within the framework of halacha. Look, we desperately need spiritual leadership. People are searching for the word of God. And for me to limit the spiritual leadership to 50% of the pool, for me, doesn't make sense. And permit me just for a moment to say just a word about Rabbi Sarah Horowitz. She is a woman of unusual dignity. She is humble and learned and caring, and in the face of sometimes terribly distasteful criticism and shameful disrespect, she really has carried herself so nobly. And she deserves all the credit in the world. And now she's the dean of Yeshivat Maharat, and it's a good thing. She's doing well, and the work that these women are going to be doing within the framework of the halakha is really l'shem ultif eret. May they all be blessed.
Let's talk a little bit of what you just alluded to. There's a sort of culture of criticism that's currently taking place in Orthodoxy that I don't think is new. I mean, there's always been a culture of criticism.
I see Julian Henry going, take care. You need friends like Henry and Julia, believe me. Dear friends.
Why do you feel that we've reached a point where these issues of disagreement or even profound dispute can't really be discussed civilly anymore? It's sort of, there's a culture of rejection where groups and individuals do not seem capable even of engaging in dialogue. How do we reach that point? Is it possible, are there ways of moving past that point?
You know, first, most people do dialogue with us. But it is true, there are those who don't. I think about that, but I don't spend that much time on it. And I think one has to ask those who are unwilling to dialogue. I'm willing to dialogue. Chovevei Torah is willing to dialogue. And by the way, Chovevei Torah is not me at all. Chovevei Torah, permit me just a few moments on that. Chovevei Torah is an institution that is headed by one of the most brilliant Talmidei Chachamim in the world, Rabbi Dov Lenzer. He is the head of the school, and he is so magnificently learned. It's not uncommon that a Rosh Yeshiva, who's glued to the Gemara, you could become very narrow. He's as open-minded as he is brilliant on every line of the Gemara. And I'm grateful to him. He's my partner. I'm so grateful to others whom you know. You should bring them up here. Rabbi Natty Helfgott, Rabbi Yisrael Katz, Rabbi Yaakov Love, so many, many people who have made such an extraordinary contribution. We're blessed with Dr. Michelle Belfer Friedman. It's not uncommon for women to be teaching rabbinical students. She introduced a pastoral psychology program that is now being emulated by rabbinical schools across the denominations. In a certain sense, she has literally rewritten rabbinic education. There are brilliant people in leadership who come in to teach leadership. Because, I mean, a rabbi as a leader is complicated. Because a rabbi is not a politician. A rabbi is not a social worker. A rabbi is a rabbi and leads. But you're leading a community. And how you process and how you balance that takes, in fact, a tremendous maven. Our goal is we want our students to come out of Chovevei Torah. We want them, first of all, to come out and serve. I'm happy to say that almost 100% of our almost 70 graduates are serving. We want our graduates to serve Am Yisrael. We want them to have a breadth and a depth of Torah knowledge that also has the wisdom of the world, the ability to listen, something we teach in pastoral psychology, to listen, the ability to lead. All of this requires the kind of input of the faculty and the kind of students that we have. But I would say that the diamond, the jewel of Chovevei Torah, is absolutely our students. Most rabbinical schools, when you walk into the Bet Midrash and you walk into the offices, you see pictures of the Rabbeim. Come to Chovevei Torah. You know what you're going to see? You're going to see pictures of our students. Pictures of our students. There are now, I'm so proud of them. It's like a father telling you about them. There are now 26, almost 30 students serving in synagogues around North America. Each is different. Uri Topolowski does his work in New Orleans. The synagogue that was destroyed in New Orleans from Katrina, he's rebuilding. And it's an extraordinary story because, as you may know, he was renting facilities from, I'm not even sure that they charged him, from the Reform Temple. And now he's building just adjacent to the Reform Temple. And his building is very much supported by the Orthodox Union. Almost all of our students who are in synagogues are in OU synagogues. Rabbi Aaron Levy is right here. He lives downtown, saw that there are young Jews downtown who are searching, and so he created a synagogue called Makom. He's a creator. Rabbi Nissen Antin is going to be the next rabbi of Rabbi Joel Tesler, is going on sabbatical. This is a 450-500 family shul. He's going to become the senior rabbi, the rabbi of Cedar Sinai, arguably the biggest chaplaincy of any hospital in the country, is Rabbi Jason Wiener. There are now 23 Chovevei students who are in educational forums. And now that they've been around for a while, they're assuming leadership. Listen to where they go. The head of Judaic Studies at Shalhevet, which is the modern Orthodox high school, comes from Chovevei Ari Lubitz, and the rabbi of 1 through 8 of the Heschel Community School is also from Chovevei. And we're terribly and absolutely proud of each of them. I don't spend much time, truly, on the detractors. It's a waste of energy. We try to be proactive. Our energy goes to recruiting students, and our incoming class is going to be our largest students. We have our largest number of applicants, recruiting, training, and placing. And we hope, God willing, with God's help, to place hundreds of students all over North America, and we hope soon to have greater impact right here in this great city.
I'm going to throw it open to the floor in just a minute. So if people want to ask a question, you should line up at the mic. But I'll close our interview by quoting someone who was almost a generation before you in terms of contemporary modern Orthodoxy. In 1966, in an interview given to the Yeshiva University student newspaper, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg delivered some rather bracing comments regarding Orthodoxy at that time. He said, among other things, that Orthodoxy refuses to come out of the East European ghetto psychologically. In the ghetto, Orthodoxy floated off into its own world and is still living there. It has escaped into the purely ritualistic realm of halakha and has made a routine out of it. I think that the basis of Orthodoxy's escape is the belief that the Torah cannot stand up to the challenge of contemporary civilization, and thus our withdrawal from society is a means of saving God or covering up his weakness. Our desire to withdraw is an indication of our unwillingness to admit that our beliefs are shallow. One with a religious attitude would not ignore America, but would question why we were brought here and how we can utilize America for the realization of Jewish personal and social ideals. As someone like yourself who has an enormous commitment to traditional Judaism and yet is intensely engaged with the intellectual and sociopolitical currents of modernity, I wonder what your feelings are about this, I guess, a good 45 years later. Does it seem like a valid critique? Does it seem flawed? And I guess I'm wondering how you see the future, how you see the future of Orthodoxy in terms of its market share, how many adherents we'll have, and how it will relate to the world around it and to other Jewish denominations as well, including your vision of Orthodoxy. Do you feel it will spread, will grow? Will it be able to thrive?
Yitz is one of my dearest friends, Yitz and Blue, and I'm forever grateful to them for their friendship. There have been many, many lonely moments that I've experienced, and it's the friendship of people like Rabbi Greenberg and Blue. the profound sense of respect and friendship that I feel towards Rabbi Saul Berman, whom I consider really a Rebbe Chaver, and my dearest friend Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, who's been just such a wonderful, wonderful mentor and friend. So when you mention Yitz's name, it touches me. I know Yitz well, and my sense is from what you read that I don't know where it comes from, but this was probably an in-house statement, because I think, knowing Rabbi Greenberg, he'd be the first one to say that there's much good in what was then in the 60s modern orthodoxy, about the Hashem and passion and commitment. But as Rabbi Greenberg does, he was pushing. It was an internal critique. Considering when he wrote it, I think at that time I didn't think he was right. I didn't think that he was right that we were moving towards insulation. As it turns out, I think he was right. I think 45 years later, that's why there's a Chovevei Torah. I think the community is moving precipitously to the right. I think that, in fact, that is occurring. And so in that sense, I think that Yitz really did touch a nerve. And we're going to, you know, when it comes to the Orthodox community, I would say it this way: there's good news and bad news. The good news is that Orthodox synagogues and Orthodox schools, I see my dear friend Rabbi Scott Berman, who's the educator's educator here, a dear friend, I think our schools and our synagogues are more crowded than ever. That's the good news. The bad news is that for 80% of North American Jewry, Orthodoxy is irrelevant. And so in that sense, I think he really did hit something. And that's why, on some level, Chovevei was created. You know, anything that's created anew, I believe any change is a response to a need. But if you remain a reaction, you will not endure. We, Chovevei Torah, is no longer a reaction. It's proactive. Proactive in doing exactly what I had spelled out. So I think he did turn out to be right. I think the issue that he raises about ritual and routine, that is, you can go through ritual and get to the point that it becomes routine, this goes all the way back. The Ramban, sure, in Kedoshim Tihiyu, the Ramban says, why does the Torah have to say Kedoshim Tihiyu? You should be holy. Just follow the mitzvot. The sum total of the mitzvot obviously is you're going to be holy. To which the Ramban says no. He says you can keep every mitzvah, every minutia, and his words are you can be a naval birshut haTorah. You can be repugnant or an abomination with the permission of the Torah. So it's very important, as we commit ourselves to halacha, and open orthodoxy is a commitment to the minutia of halacha, that we recognize that the commitment is a pathway to something larger. That's what the word halacha means. It comes from the word halach, which means to go. The Maral says, halacha comes from God's words to Abraham, italech lefanai veyei tamim. Follow the halacha and you'll achieve wholeness. The purpose of halacha is to attain kedusha. So it's a great thing when people are more passionate about their davening. It's very important. And we've got to get more real when it comes to that stuff. Open orthodoxy is not orthodoxy light. It's being serious about Torah. It's being serious about learning. It's being serious about davening. But with all that, there is a larger purpose, and that larger purpose is kedusha. I think there's another area I would add of great concern that I have in open orthodoxy is, and this is for a separate discussion, but I'm very concerned about the movement towards the centralization of the power of the rabbinate. It hasn't worked in Israel, and there's an attempt to bring it here, and I think it's a terrible, terrible mistake. At Chovevei, we always say, We are graduating students, and we don't want to control our students in the field. We want to empower them. We believe them. We believe that when our students are in the field, that they're when they're going to do a wedding, they're going to do it properly, they're going to do it halachically, and we believe that when they're going to do a gerus, true, when they're younger rabbis, there are all kinds of, there's a system in place where they should go to the senior rabbis, but we believe in them. And that's what I think it should be that way. There's a great rabbi in this synagogue, Rabbi Chaim Strachla. You can trust him. You don't need a more centralized authority than Rabbi Strachla. And I think that this, too, is going to be a point of tension between modern, or what I call open orthodoxy, and our brothers and sisters whom I love, but with whom I, on certain issues, disagree, the Orthodox right.
Rabbi Weiss, thank you very much. We have some time for questions. If people want to step up to the mic, please. There's a mic right in front, and if you wish to ask a question, just head over there. Can you stand up and speak into the mic, please? Because that way everybody will hear your question.
By the way, for those who are going, go to the Yeshivat Chovevei Torah website. You're welcome to take a look at it. And I wanted to welcome you when you come to New York to visit our Bet Midrash. Please feel so welcome. And if there are any men who are interested in applying to Chovevei Torah, please see me afterwards. And if there are any women, if you know of any women interested in Yeshivat Marat, bevakasha. Yeah, no, the question was, what was my stand on the issue of conversion? And I would say it is not we who changed the status quo. I was very, very happy with Orthodox rabbis in the field doing conversions. And when there would be an anomaly and there would be an Orthodox rabbi who was conducting himself in an egregious way, we knew not to accept those conversions. I very strongly feel that Orthodox rabbis are competent, they know halakha, and above all, they know their situations and conditions in their particular communities, in their particular synagogues. And I think the move now to centralize conversion is a mistake. And I think we're seeing that in Israel as well. We're at the point now where, at a certain point in time, the chief rabbinate was invalidating Reb Chaim Druckmann's conversions, the conversions that were being done in the army. I mean, the joke going around is that if God performed conversions, there would be those who would not be validating each of those conversions. So I'm very concerned, and I believe that the way to move forward, and I think a mistake, is centralization of power is problematic. Centralization of power is not a good thing. Power corrupts. And you become vulnerable. Now, it is true, like everything, centralization, one could argue, creates certain parameters, but I think the give is too great. I think marriages should be in the hands of local rabbis, and I think conversions should be in the hands of local rabbis.
Just wondered if you ever get discouraged and feel like you're fighting a very uphill battle.
You know, I would say, first, what's your first name?
Francis.
What's your real name? Your Hebrew name? From a Sarah. Francis, I feel so blessed. I really feel blessed. I've been in the rabbinate over 40 years. I was ordained when I was 9 years old. There was this youth phenomena. I feel so blessed. I'm still excited by what I do. The rabbinate is not my vocation. It's my avocation. It's both. I can't believe how God has blessed me. I go to daven every morning. I share some Torah. I participate in a brit and a simchat bat. I try to be there for people in need, visit a home of people who are lonely, go to the hospital, give a shiur, and they pay me for this. Not much, but they pay me for it. The truth of the matter is I've never signed a contract in my life. I've never asked for a raise in my life. It's just not something I'm concerned about. I say this because you ask, am I ever discouraged? I just feel blessed. I feel blessed. I feel blessed by the bayit. I feel so blessed. God has blessed me with the most extraordinary students. I wouldn't say that I'm discouraged, but you know, when you have to, over the past 10 years, we've raised close to well over $25 million. That's a lot of money. A lot of matzah, as Shlomo Carlbach would say. A blessed memory. But when I walk through that threshold into the Bet Midrash, I feel like I'm flying. When I visit communities where our students are serving as rabbis, I feel like I'm flying. They're so precious to me. And if you were to ask me, what would be some of the most fundamental ingredients of the rabbinate? I wouldn't hesitate to say there are a whole bunch of them, but one of them is tenacity. That means, I remember when I came back from St. Louis, my first shtetl was in St. Louis. I was there for a year. And Dr. Belkin invited me to come back to teach. But, it was a hard year, even though it was a glorious year. I love St. Louis. He said to me, Abraham, what does kol hatchalot kashot mean? I said, Rebbe, it means all beginnings are difficult. So he said to me, Avram, why is it in the plural? Why is it kol hatchalot kashot? It should be kol hatchala, every beginning. Why is it beginnings? I said, Rebbe, because I guess people are involved in many ventures, and it's referring to the many ventures. He said, no, you got it wrong. It's referring to one venture. You fall, you get up. You fall, you get up. But Chovevei Torah is moving out of the dream stage, and now we're moving into the stage of digging deep institutional roots. And thank God, we're doing better than ever. I invite you, if anybody is interested, let me know.
Well, I just wanted to point out that Rabbi Linzer's Daf Yomi Shir is now being run by Torah Motion online. You can see it. You'll be able to get his shir online through our website every day. So that's except for Shabbat, yes. Are there any further questions?
What's your name?
Ellie.
Your Hebrew name?
Ellie. So you commented on centralization and your concern about that.
Yes.
My question is, most institutions have centralized power, corporations, judicial systems, government. What is unique about orthodoxy that you think won't permit to a well-functioning centralized body?
Look, the papacy is centralized too. And I think one of the differences between Judaism and the papacy is that we're not centralized. We were centralized in the First and the Second Commonwealth, but once the temple was destroyed, there were different lights of centralization. And the centralization was Torah. Torah in different communities, led by rabbis in partnership with their communities. And that's, I believe, what made Torah vibrant. There were parameters, clear boundaries, but within those boundaries, each and every rabbi had a specific amount of latitude. And I think we're making a mistake when we move towards centralization. And I think it's part of what's happening in society today, where there is a drifting towards absolutism. There's a political move to the right. I think people are under the impression, with intermarriage and assimilation at such a high rate, that the response is to circle the wagons. There's this sense that only the right is authentic. And I respectfully disagree. I think that halachic creativity and what halacha is all about is this within boundaries, I keep saying, is this dialectic? And that's what I think is required into the future.
Again, I want to thank Rabbi Weiss for coming, and I want to thank the Schiff family for sponsoring this program. Good night, everybody. Thank you.